Russia returned to its tactics of destroying Ukrainian energy infrastructure, attempting to plunge Ukrainians into darkness. Ukrainians across the country endured a week of unprecedented combined aerial attacks. Meanwhile, as March marked the 10th anniversary of the illegal referendum in occupied Crimea, we reflect on political and ethnic persecution by the Russian occupiers. You're listening to the podcast Explaining Ukraine. The Explaining Ukraine podcast is produced by Ukraine World, an English language website about Ukraine. My name is Volodymyr Yarmolenko. I'm chief editor of Ukraine World. I invite you to a regular conversation between my colleagues Anastasia Harasymchuk and Daria Senhayevska, journalists and analysts at Ukraine World. They analyzed key events in and around Ukraine during the last week. Let me remind you that Ukraine World is brought to you by Internews Ukraine, one of the largest Ukrainian media NGOs. Let me also remind you that you can support our work at patreon.com/ukraineworld. You can also support our volunteer trips to the front lines at PayPal, ukraine.resisting@gmail.com. You can find these links in the description of this episode.
Russia has intensified its aerial attacks on Ukrainian cities. It uses all possible means for its air strikes, from the strike UAVs to different kinds of missiles like cruise missiles, ballistic missiles, or hypersonic missiles. These types of weaponry may sound familiar to you, but what is peculiar about the current situation that Russia has widened the types of missiles and weapons in general within each category. For example, Russia used new types of hypersonic missiles, Zircon, to attack Kyiv. Since Ukraine has better air defense capabilities than it had the last year, Russians decided to widen this variety of airstrike means it uses. And what is unfortunately as well that not all the Ukrainian regions have these air defense capacities to protect themselves from ballistic and hypersonic missiles attacks. Russia is well aware of that. Moreover, it drew lessons from its previous mistakes. It also conducts active reconnaissance actions to find the ways to bypass Ukrainian air defense. And it uses new tactics of attacks. And even though the Ukrainian air defense and armed forces managed to shoot down the majority of air targets, still those which reach their aim cause huge destructions. What is peculiar about this wave of attacks is that Russia returned to the tactics of destroying the energy infrastructure of Ukraine. On the night of the 22nd of March, Ukraine endured the most massive air attack on its energy infrastructure since the beginning of the full-scale invasion. Indeed, the scale of destruction as well as geography of the attack was immense. Almost all the regions were targeted. And when we talk about the destructions, the scope of destructions, a huge number of power generation and transmission facilities were damaged or completely destroyed. And here we talk about thermal and hydroelectric power plants, substations, transmission and distribution grids. So at this attack, Russia used 151 means of aerial attack. And as a result, the main power generation producer, DTEC, lost 50% of its generation capacities. According to the estimates of specialists in the power in the energy sphere, it will take months to restore the energy capacities of Ukraine. And in some cases, it may take more than a year. Also, Ukrainians remembered what the word blackout means. So after this immense attack in a big amount, in a big number of regions, like Odessa, Donetsk, Dnipropetrovsk, Sumy, Kirovohrad, Kharkiv, and Poltava oblasts, people suffered from emergency blackouts. And unfortunately, after this big attack, there were subsequent attacks on of smaller scale, but still they were aimed at the energy infrastructure. So they destabilized the situation even more. But despite these terrible consequences and huge burden on the energy infrastructure of Ukraine, the power engineers managed to stabilize the situation. So currently just several regions face these blackouts, emergency or stabilization. However, taking into account the scope of destructions and damages, this strike might have long-term consequences, and the energy specialists tell about the negative consequences for the energy system of Ukraine exactly in summer. However, Ukrainian services do everything possible to cope with this situation, and the repairing works are ongoing. And what is important to note here, that the situation is under control now. And even though the strike was of unprecedented scale, the majority of Ukrainians do not suffer from power outages.
And another strengthening point of Ukraine as an energy securitizer actor, I would say, is that we are now connected with European SOS system. That means the synchronization of power grids of Ukraine and Europe that unites us as one of the essential level, and this level is energy sector. This means that Ukraine, we know, had terminated the last connection with Russia's energy system that was like from Soviet times, and we now know that this synchronization allows us to significantly increase the reliability of operation of the Ukrainian power system and ensure security of electricity supply to our consumers.
That's true, and this factor was indeed extremely important in the terms of coping with the consequences of this attack. And it is also important to note that actually Ukraine was preparing for the attacks on its infrastructure, and the defense constructions were created to protect the energy facilities better. And the power engineers also piled the necessary amount of details and components to repair what was damaged. So as I've already told, nowadays, about a week after attack, just several regions face some problems with electricity, among which are Odessa Oblast and Kharkiv Oblast. And I myself reside in Odessa, so I know the situation from inside. Currently, we have stabilization blackouts, which means that there is the schedule according to which we know when there will be power outages, and we can plan our days accordingly. But the most difficult situation is in Kharkiv, because almost all the generation facilities were destroyed there. But what is extremely important to note here is that power engineers in the region made something akin to miracle, because despite these heavy, severe destructions, as of now, the 80% of households are already with electricity. So we can just admire and praise the immense efforts and courage of power engineers and specialists in this sphere. I also would like to mention the incident that took place as a result of the attack, which could have become a man-made disaster of unprecedented scale. During that attack at night on the 22nd of March, Russia hit the Dnipro hydroelectric power plant, the biggest hydroelectric power plant in Ukraine. So the facility sustained 8 hits. They were heavy damages, and now the hydroelectric power plant doesn't fully operate, and specialists say that it will take years to fully restore it. As the result of this attack, as the result of the damage caused to the equipment in the power plant, the oil products got into the Dnipro River, which is actually a huge scale of water pollution. But it's a huge and extreme luck that despite those heavy damages, the dam of the Dnipro hydroelectric power plant wasn't destroyed. And currently, the overall situation is under control and there are no risks of the dam breakthrough, which is a big relief for Ukraine and entire Europe. So just let's think why Russia restored to these tactics again, and it happened not in winter, but exactly now. According to the Institution for the Study of War, Russia decided to launch this kind of attack exactly now because Ukraine faces the lack of ammunition and lack of missiles, including for the air defense capabilities, air defense system. So in face of this situation, when Ukrainian air defense capabilities are weaker than they were, it was a good, let's say, good chance for Russians to cause this heavy damage. According to the analysts of this institute, these attacks on energy infrastructure might be not the last ones, and Russia might continue to conduct these kind of attacks. And one of the main targets here was not only like terrorizing the Ukrainian population. Amid the amassed weapons production in Ukraine, amidst the intensive development of defense industry complex, these attacks on energy infrastructure had an aim to undermine the defense industry complex operation. So it was like one of the main tasks of Russians, so that Ukraine wouldn't manage to grow and develop its defense military complex further. And of course, terrorization of Ukrainian population is not the least important aim for Russians. They're trying to destabilize situation inside Ukraine, and these like problems with providing yourself with the basic means like electricity, water, heating, etc., according to Russians, might cause a certain kind of negative processes within the country. But it's a huge miscalculation, because even though Ukrainians are facing these difficulties and they are under the constant threat, still Ukrainians remain resilient and they understand who their enemy really is.
And what strikes the most is this trend that we can observe. So we know that this attacks on energy infrastructure is not the first in times of not only this big war since 2014, but also before that with the points of terrorizing Ukrainian society and blackmailing authorities to achieve what Kremlin wants. But the Ukrainian power system is interconnected with the power system of Moldova. So if you recall the attacks of 2022, they were also a destabilizing factor in Moldova's internal political situation. There were still manipulations of Russia gas supplies to Moldova connected to the volumes of electricity generated by a Russian-owned company in the unrecognized region of Transnistria, which is used for Moldova's needs. And we also remember that protests in the country were related to Russia's destabilization of gas markets and power outrages resulting from damage of the Ukrainian system. And at that point, Russia was trying to change the government in Moldova to one of their liking so that Ukraine receives another unfriendly state on its borders. Now, Moldova switched to European gas via Ukraine to reduce its dependence on Russian gas, and the massive attacks that you, Nastya, described are oriented on blackmailing of Ukrainians and cutting down capacities of Ukrainian cities to maintain themselves. We can overall see that Russia has become more active for a number of reasons. They are very concerned about the operations of the intelligence service of Ukraine, and there is information that the buildings of the main intelligence directorate and the foreign intelligence service could have been targeted. Obviously, our special services are quite active and create a lot of problems for the enemy. And to some extent, this is a recognition of how effective the Ukrainian intelligence community works. This is a recognition that they are extremely active, conducting operations that cause these troubles, and later on we'll uncover more details about that. To take revenge, Russia does best it can, fighting against civilians. We know stories from our frontier cities. And to terrorize the civilian population of Kharkiv, the enemy uses S-300 missiles with a range of up to 350 kilometers with a ballistic trajectory that reduces the chances of being shot down by Ukrainian air defense systems. So we see this different patterns of attacking. For example, Kyiv remains the main symbolic, political, strategic aim for Russian occupiers. And those cities that borders or somehow close to the occupied territories, for example, Odessa and Mykolaiv, if we talk about ballistic missiles that were launched from temporarily occupied Crimea, or Kharkiv and Sumy that suffers such massive number of barrages per day that it can shock any correspondent, any journalist that were there, and when they return, they not in a good way astonished by how brutal this regime could be with waging war against those who can't protect themselves because they are non-combatants, they are civilians. And circling back, the Russian Federation has large stockpiles of these missiles, up to 2,500, and their shelf life is up to 30 years. Therefore, the Russians are faced with a choice, either to dispose of the missiles, spending money from the budget, or to use them to hit frontline cities. This is why the occupiers are using them to hit Kherson, Kharkiv, and Zaporizhia.
And what is also important to mention here, that even though Russia has huge piles of ammunitions, its own ammunitions, like back from Soviet times, we also should mention that it gets as like huge loads of ammunitions from its allies, like North Korea. And there was information that North Korea has already transferred 10,000 containers with ammunitions to Russia. And there were also already cases when the North Korean ballistic missiles were used against Ukrainian cities. So that is something to keep in mind while we are talking about the allies' ties and the effectiveness of supplies. While Ukraine faces the problems with getting what it needs, Russia, with its partners within the Axis of Evil, have this effective cooperation and gets what it needs in not just sufficient, but in huge amounts. So the situation is indeed difficult, and we face these tragedies of destruction and loss of lives every day, and we live in this negative context, but still we do not give up, and this negative context is not the only one we live in. We are trying to focus on the positive side of the issue. And now it's the moment to shift to more positive developments. And here I mean the successful special operations by defense forces of Ukraine that were aimed at destruction of the Russian Black Sea Fleet.
Yes, and basically I will focus on several of them because there is something to tell about. On 24th March, the defense forces attacked with a Neptune missile the landing ship Konstantin Olshansky, which the Russian occupiers stole from Ukraine in 2014 during the annexation of Crimea. The Ukrainian military also hit the Russian reconnaissance ship Ivan horse. And this ship had been in Sevastopol for 9 years. Russians began dismantling it for spare parts and looting it. But in the 10th year of the war, the occupiers realized that they were running out of large ships, so they decided to restore Konstantin Olshansky within a year. And our Navy spokesman, Dmytro Plantinchuk, added that the extent of damage to the ship is currently being determined, but it's definitely not combat ready. The Russian large assault ship Azov and Yamal, which were hit the day before, will also not be able to carry out combat missions in the near future, as will the Ivan Hurs ship. And Ukraine has upgraded its Neptune missile so that it can now operate in a surface-to-surface mode. So basically, these missiles have already been used against many targets. In particular, they attacked the cruiser Moskva and destroyed the S-400 anti-aircraft missile system, which is called Triumph. So Ukraine is on its way to upgrade what we have and finding means of deoccupying our territories. According to InfoNapalm, the Yamal large assault ship took part in the annexation of Crimea, and the Azov large amphibious assault ship rarely took part in military exercises or any, let's say, international voyages. More often, the Russians liked to show it off. For example, it was used for a film about the construction of the Novorossiysk naval base. But what draws our attention is that Ivan Hurs' ship was designed for reconnaissance, and there are only two ships of this design in the Russian Navy. And the main task of it is electronic warfare, communications, fleet management, and initially it was supposed to join the Russian Pacific Fleet, but it was decided to send it to the Black Sea to replace the sunken ship Liman, which also was the ship with such aims like electronic warfare and like communications and other things like that. And the official task of this ship is to ensure the security of the Turkish Stream and Blue Stream pipelines. However, its designers intended it to be a flagship for, network-centric warfare and to coordinate the actions of air and ground forces. Solely, it can provide command and control of troops and coordinate the actions of aviation and ground forces. In addition, it has more modern equipment, let's put it in such way. So even the temporary loss of the ship will affect the Black Sea Fleet's ability to perform various tasks, and in previous episodes we delved deeper into what tasks the Black Sea Fleet can cope with now, and which tasks are out of their control. So basically, point by point, by each operation of our intelligence service, we see how Crimea, for example, is getting closer and closer to its origins, to Ukraine's control. And we see the overall idea of Crimean Peninsula is somehow moved forward by Russian regime as a territory that belongs to Russia. But what Russia doing is trying to colonize it. This process has several dimensions, but the non-recognition of Ukrainians as a separate nation that lives in there, that its sovereignty of the state and its Ukraine's decision what type of power there should be, not it should not be brought by Russians, and we see this threat in the speeches of Russian propagandists on how Crimea is important for Russia, but basically because of military means and with military purposes. So I guess now it's time to pay more attention in our episode for this particular topic.
Yes, touching upon the topic of Crimea, for our team, March has been a month with Crimea and Crimean Tatars in particular in focus. 10 years ago, on the 16th of March, the illegal pseudo referendum took place in the peninsula, and that it finalized the occupation of Crimea by Russian forces. Since then, the non-Russian population of Crimea has become subject to politically and ethnically motivated persecutions, especially when it comes to Crimean Tatars. So Crimean Tatars are actually indigenous population of the peninsula, and we can find their roots there since the 12th century. Crimean Tatars had their own state in the Crimean Peninsula. It was called Crimean Khanate. But in 1783, Russian Empire came there and destroyed the Crimean Tatar state. And since then, the occupation of the peninsula started. So it faced like almost 2 centuries of occupation by Russian Empire. Then there was the Soviet occupation, and now it is occupied by the current Russian Federation. What is important to note in this context that these occupational activities and well-adjusted Russian ethnic policy led to artificial change of ethnic makeup of the population. And when we talk about the 60% of Russians living in the peninsula, we should keep in mind that it was created artificially, and it doesn't have anything in common with the indigenous population of the peninsula. So the Russians artificially created these conditions, deporting and eradicating the local population of Crimea. And I had an honor to talk with Tamila Tashova, the permanent representative of the president of Ukraine in Crimea, about what is actually going on with the non-Crimean population of the peninsula. And since the occupation in 2014, the persecutions have started, and they became much more severe and widespread already after the full-scale invasion in 2022. And now there are 214 individuals who are persecuted under the pretext of Russian repressive law. So we are talking about these sham legal persecutions. And out of this number of people, of this amount of people, out of 214 Crimean cases, 135 persecuted are Crimean Tatars. And they face these full charges of extremism. These people, Ukrainians and to a greater extent Crimean Tatars, are being killed. There are cases of enforced disappearances. And what has become even more acute after the full-scale invasion, in violation of international humanitarian law, Russia conscripts to its army the population of the occupied territories. So people, Ukrainian and Crimean Tatar people on the peninsula are facing this forced mobilization. And now the bigger number of Crimean Tatars have been leaving the peninsula. They are leaving their homeland, and the entire families are leaving it. And Ukraine calls it hybrid or quiet deportation. Like in the 20th century, the Stalinist regime committed genocide against Crimean Tatars, deporting them to Central Asian countries, loading them into freight cars. Now Crimean Tatars are driven out of the peninsula because of these persecutions, repressions, and forced mobilization. When we talk about rights of non-Russian population there, we also should keep in mind that all these spheres of life are under Russian control, even if we talk about religion. When it comes to Orthodoxy and Christianity in general, the Russian patriarchy is in charge of everything. But when we talk about Muslims, they are also are under effective Russian control. And the religious administration of Muslims of Crimea are in charge of religious affairs of Muslims. And this body currently is also under the control of Russian special services. This process didn't happen immediately. Like, it was the whole process of subjugating this body. And the religious leaders of Muslim population of Crimea, they were blackmailed, they were threatened, and that's how Russians forced them to collaboration. And talking about those false persecutions charges against Ukrainian and Crimean Tatar population, as Tamila Tasheva told, Russians decided that with the occupation of the territory, they can just appropriate the population of the peninsula. And the problem is that neither Ukraine nor international community can take effective steps to help and to assist local population to protect themselves against Russian persecutions. First of all, these people who are persecuted, they are civilians. And according to the international law, Ukraine just cannot include these people into the list of exchanges. That's the first point. The second point is that Ukraine doesn't have Russian civilian hostages to conduct these changes. So there are no legal tools actually to force Russians release our political prisoners. The actions are actually limited, and the only things we as a country can do and our partners is keep the world informed about what is going on, not to let forget about those people and to somehow prevent tortures and other illegal things that could happen to our prisoners. What is alarming in this situation is that Russia considers the population of Crimea as their own citizens. And even if people residing here didn't get the Russian documents, they are still considered to be Russian citizens by Russian occupational authorities. And even those who do not live on the territory of the peninsula. And here, very telling is the case of Linye Umerova. She is a young Crimean Tatar woman. She wasn't residing in Crimea, but she had her father there. So in 2022, she went to Crimea to visit her father, and she was the only person in the bus who didn't have Russian documents. That is why she was detained by the Russian border officials and special forces, exactly under the pretext of not having Russian documents. And then she was detained under the pretext of espionage. So she is falsely accused of espionage, and she is under the threat of being detained for long years in Russia. So you can read much more about the current state of Crimean Tatars on the peninsula and what Ukraine and international community do or can do to assist this population in our article, which was recently published on our platforms. And I also would like to invite you to read several more materials that were written our colleagues about the Crimean topic. Our colleagues, journalists Nika Krychovska and Elizaveta July, wrote wonderful articles. The first one is about key facts about Crimean Tatar population. So about their roots, about their peculiarities. So you can find out very interesting details and like the truth about history of Crimea and Crimean Tatar population. And our colleague Elizaveta July collected and retold a story of a Ukrainian writer, Evgenia Henova, who made a book compiled of Crimean Tatars' family stories, personal stories. She was, our colleague was present at the presentation of the book herself, and she managed to talk to the author of this book. So it's a very interesting take, and you can find out more about the author of this book, about the stories from this book themselves, and you can read about several real-life characters of that book. So we are inviting you to visit our platforms and to get familiarized with our materials about Crimea and Crimean Tatars.
Indeed, our colleagues did a brilliant job, and I fully agree with Nastya that it's worth attention and worth time reading it. And the another dimension that I guess some how and sometimes is being overlooked is the dimension of neocolonial aspirations of Russia, this dimension of colonization of identity. Because what you said, Nastya, about that Russia considers Crimean Peninsula and residents who live there as their citizens, even though some might not have like Russian documents. We see this long history that firstly, Russia has banned the Majlis, the main political body of the Crimean Tatars. In 2021, the leaders of this of the Majlis were either arrested or exiled, and the first deputy of it, Nariman Jalalov, the most powerful voice of the Crimean Tatar people, was also imprisoned for 17 years for his participation in the Crimean Platform Summit on returning Crimea to Ukraine. And after the Russian occupation of Crimea, only 3% of children can learn the Crimean Tatar language, and there are no Ukrainian schools left at all. The Russians brought in weapons, soldiers, and reactivated military units to militarize the peninsula. As I have already mentioned, the greatest importance of Crimean Peninsula to Russia is the military one. And around 1,000 missiles have been launched from Crimea. The Russians have returned it into, turned it into a platform for their aggression. And Russia is working for a third time to transform Crimea's demographics. So we know that before the first annexation of Crimea in the 18th century, 95% of the population of the Crimean Peninsula were Crimean Tatars, but this share has now decreased to 13%. Then we have the deportation of 1944, and today's efforts are also the process of Russian colonization. Also, when thinking about Crimean Peninsula, I recall this stance that literature is artistic way of living through events and communicate them with the wider public. And I was astonished by the work of Svetlana Taratorina, who is the author of the novel House of Salt. And she is a Crimean itself, and she couldn't start writing a novel immediately after the annexation of Crimea in 2014 because this event became a family tragedy. And then in 2018, she had two goals. On the one hand, she wanted to understand what happened to Crimea and why Russia had such an easy time annexing the peninsula. And on the other hand, she wanted to find her Crimean identity and understand the history of Peninsula. So I guess this motive of uncovering the identity, of researching one's self-identity in this mosaic history, this long history of repression of Crimean Tatars by Russian regimes, is now alive, and each and every person who has this roots, who has this curiosity of finding out what happens to Crimean Peninsula now and what happened back then, back in, for example, 18th century, should take this as a goal of uncovering the truth. And the novel.
And you, Dasha, you also reminded me of, while talking about the culture, you actually reminded me of the instance attack on the cultural heritage of Crimean Tatars. And it was told by Tamila Tashva. Mm-hmm. Like there is this unique monument to Crimean Tatar culture and history. It is Bakhchisarai Khan's palace. And now Russia is doing everything to destroy it. So under the pretense of reconstruction, it's actually rebuilding this palace. So that the cultural code and its historical value is being destroyed. And Russians are doing it to deprive the Crimean Peninsula of its real real face, the Crimean Tatar face. So what was being done back in the 18th century and in the 20th century is being continued, and the world is losing its cultural heritage. The world is losing the truth about it. And again, talking about the rights of Crimean Tatars, I also recall the episode from the Evgenia Hanova's book. She mentioned the case of Gulnara, and Gulnara recalled her childhood years when she was studying at school, and to share a place with her classmates, to sit next to her in school, her classmates had to get permission from their parents. Otherwise, the teachers wouldn't let the other children share space with Crimean Tatars. So Russian regimes, different kinds of Russian regimes, were not only destroying culture and eradicate real history of the peninsula. They were discriminating and humiliating people under the ethnical grounds. And it's especially cruel towards children. So this disregard of dignity and personal dignity of these people was so widespread. And these are actually painful pages of Crimean Tatars' history.
It's painful, yes, but I would rather say that the Russian annexation is only a moment in the huge timeline of the history of the real Crimea. It's painful. It covers and goes along with the stories of people, the tragedies of their families, but it's only a moment. And I hope and I know that for a while, but in some time, it will be back under Ukraine's control, and we would be able, you know, to uncover, to reestablish traditions, to help reestablish this tradition by Crimean Tatars, and all these deportations and settlement of others by Russian authorities have led to people not knowing who they are, and they need to find their identity. And here, another, you know, like metaphoric motive is the fairy tale of the golden cradle. Basically, it says that there is the hidden golden cradle in the Mount Basman is a symbol of peace and tranquility in Crimea, and that whoever finds it will have power over the land. However, the tale itself says that it is a symbol of prosperity while has not been found, and then peace will prevail. Symbolically and symptomatically for Russians, in 2015, Crimean Gauleiters hilariously presented Putin with this golden cradle, saying, "Here's power over Crimea." But again, this myth calls for fighting for one's land, so I guess the metaphor of searching for the golden cradle retains the pathos of hope for the future and for our generations. And we see these patterns of Russia forming this excess of evil with other authoritarian and totalitarian regimes for changing world order based on rule, with our world on order based on power. And we know that just a couple of days ago, ISIS militants responded in a way for the blood of Muslims, as they say in Afghanistan, Chechnya, and Syria, in Krakow City Hall near Moscow. And What is important here is that Islamic State militants are Sunnis. By the way, so is the occupied Ichkeria, or Chechnya, as Russia calls it. So solidarity with the enslaved Caucasian people is another reason of hatred of ISIS, of the Kremlin and its sympathizers. And here builds up an eye-catching trend. We know that Iran is Russia's main partner in creating the Middle East conflicts, including the war in Israel, and the Iranians are overwhelmingly Shiite. And it is sometimes difficult to know whom they hate more, Americans or Sunni Muslims. So inside this, what I'm trying to say that inside this radical far movements, movements of aggression and terror, there are also, you know, some cleavages. And Moscow and Tehran are jointly supporting Syrian dictator Assad. And we remember that the war in Syria began in 2011 with protests against Assad's dictatorship, with ISIS took advantage of it, seizing about a third of Syrian territory and 40% of Iraq. And then Assad called for help from the Russian army, Hezbollah, and Iran, and the Islamic State was almost destroyed. The whole world knows about the tragedy of 2 million city of Aleppo, which the pro-Assad coalition besieged and destroyed with bombs, chemical weapons, and starvation. Sometimes it is referred to as another analog of what Russians did in Mariupol. And we know that the day before, in the morning, Russia launched a massive attack on Ukraine using 90 missiles of various modifications and 60 drones. So Russia can use this attack and is trying to accuse Ukraine and, you know, Ukraine's alleged involvement as a pretext for further escalation of this war. And the West understands this. Basically, British Finance Minister Jeremy Gantz said that the Kremlin was creating a sort of a smokescreen of propaganda around the attack in order to defend the invasion of Ukraine and mobilize more resources. But we need to understand clearly that both ISIS and Russia are terrorist sort of regimes of power. And basically, when Putin says from the tribute that basically this terrorist attack is cruel, it's not appropriate in our world, we have to see what the Russian dictator did in Ukrainian cities like Mariupol, Sumy, Kharkiv, Mykolaiv, Odessa, all that barrages carried out, all those cities and their identity vanished out. So neither of them, I mean, ISIS or Russia, are good because they are terrorists and they are waging these actions of aggression. But we have to understand, you know, who are we talking about? Because Russian president and its supporters, basically the Russians, they all are involved in terrorism against Ukraine. So there are no good terrorists, either we talk about ISIS or Russia.
And what is shocking about this attack is that Russia is exploiting the tragedy of its people to falsely accuse Ukraine and, as you, Dasha, said, to justify its terrorist attacks on Ukrainian cities. But what is also worth mentioning here is that actually Russia was warned about the possible terrorist attack. The Western, namely the American intelligence services, warned Russia about the possible terrorist attack. And the reaction of Russian leaders was actually quite unexpected. The Russian leader told that that's actually how the Westerners were trying to destabilize situation within Russia. So I don't know if it was on purpose or it was just negligence, but the Russian authorities didn't pay due attention to this warning and did nothing to prevent this attack. And instead of focusing on its internal security, like it kept focusing its actions on terrorist actions against Ukraine.
This was a podcast explaining Ukraine by Ukraine World, an English language website about Ukraine. This was a regular conversation between Anastasia Hersemchuk and Daria Sinhaevska, journalist and analyst at Ukraine World, who analyzed key events in and around Ukraine during the last week. My name is Volodymyr Yermolenko, I'm a Ukrainian philosopher, journalist and chief editor of Ukraine World. Let me remind you that you can support our work at patreon.com/ukraineworld, and you can also support our volunteer trips to the front lines at paypal ukraine.resisting@gmail.com. Stay with us and stand with Ukraine.